Just begin by cultivating your motivation and really feeling the preciousness of this very moment, the preciousness of being alive with the opportunity to listen to the Dharma and put it into practice. And this moment is precious also because it's so rare. In our previous lives, we had to create a lot of different causes to have this opportunity. And yet this opportunity disappears very quickly. And we don't know when it will come again. And so really seeing the opportunity to listen, reflect on and meditate on the Dharma, something very rare and very precious, then let's generate the most noble motivation we can have for listening, thinking and meditating, and that's the bodhicitta, the mind fixed on attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. So let's generate that mind now and let it support our sharing of the Dharma together this evening. It's been about a month, if I remember correctly, and I'm not sure I do. We are going to start the section on offering to those who have attained the spiritual path. We didn't cover that last time, did we? Okay. Did we finish giving in particular to those who harm us?
No.
Oh, how far did we get? Yeah. Yeah. So it's talking about, transforming our body into what the beings in the lower realms want. And particularly, here, if we go back to page 65, we're talking about the beings who harmed us, but to remember in the process of doing so that that they have all been our mothers before, and to remember that we too have harmed them in previous lives. So rather than just our mind getting very stuck on the idea that this is my enemy and they always have been, being able to see that they haven't always been our enemy, and that sometimes we've been the ones who have been giving the harm, and they have also been ones who are kind, have been kind to us. Okay, so the Nanka Pal, our author, says, since this is their right, because we have a debt of kindness to repay to them, because the people who've harmed us have also been kind to us, since this is their right, imagining their obtaining what they each wish in their respective forms, food for the hungry, clothes for the needy, shelter for the homeless, friends and servants for those who yearn for them. Of the food supplied the three dairy products, so milk, butter, and yogurt, and the three sweets, sugar, molasses, and honey. Okay, and flesh and blood for those who want them. So for all the carnivores, we literally offer the flesh and blood of our body. Give liberally without restraint, Let those who want flesh eat it. Let those who want blood drink it. Let those who want bones to gnaw on them. Let those who want skins wear them. Okay. Whether they want raw food immediately or cooked food eventually, let them have it. So this sounds kind of grotesque, doesn't it? You know, giving kind of, okay, all the beings who want flesh, let them eat my flesh. All the ones who want blood, let them drink my blood. You know, they can cook it, they can eat it raw. And it sounds really gross. Okay, for people who are meat eaters, that's exactly what you're doing, though, with other people's bodies. Yeah, eating their flesh, drinking their blood, wearing their hides when we wear leather shoes or so on, wearing their hides. Yeah, so it's exactly the same thing. But when we read it in a book and we think of us giving our body that way, it sounds so bleh. But for us eating others' body, oh, no problem. Yeah, maybe I shouldn't tell this. But in the Tibetan monasteries in South India, they used to serve a lot of meat, even in the prayer hall. I think now they don't do it so much, but they used to on special festivals when donors would make offerings, they would serve meat. But inside the, where you have the main temple, to get to that compound, you have to go through some gates. And so the gates have these bars going across them, you know, just one way. And I asked about it, and one monk explained to me that that's so that the cows don't wander in, you know, because they won't walk across something with bars like that because they recognize their feet can get stuck. And then he himself made the remark, oh, when they're alive, we don't want them to come in, but when they're dead, we want them to come in. True. Yeah, thank goodness they don't do that quite as much. But it's the similar kind of thing, you know, and eating meat. What is it we're doing with others? So this is returning the kindness, you know, when we've eaten others' bodies, drunk their blood, worn their hides in offering these things from our body to them. Letting them gnaw on our bones. Do you want to give your body to somebody so they can gnaw on your bones? No, this is my body. Mine. Mine. Nobody else can have it. And if they kill me to have it, they're taking my life. It's amazing how, you know, you see that very strongly, how the grasping at mine comes up, especially in relationship to the body. My body. Doesn't it? Yeah, so strongly. And yet, what is this body that we consider mine? Yeah. Recycled products from nature. Yeah? Tofu, what is it tonight? It's banana bread. And okay. So, that's all this body is. Not that much to get attached to and excited about. The moment we give it to them, they eat, their bellies fill, and being relieved of hunger, thirst, and poverty, they gain mental satisfaction. So when we give our body, we really imagine the beings who receive it having mental satisfaction. For people who do the Cho practice, this is one of the main things that you're doing in the Cho practice, is imagining giving your body to the spirits, you know, to the kind of carnivorous spirits. You give your body and they eat it, they drink it, they do with it what they want, and they experience great bliss and mental satisfaction by doing so. Now, people think Chö practice is really kind of exotic, you know. It's like, because you use those big drums. You've seen it probably, you know, on YouTube, I think. It's, you know, these very big drums. And then you have a thigh bone trumpet, a real literal human thigh bone, you know, and every so often, woo, tum, tum, know. And so when you see somebody doing it, it's, you know, it looks like, wow, you know, what are they doing? And it's so serious. And very beautiful melodies. You know, the chanting for this is very, very beautiful. So we get, oh, wow, I want to do chö. This is like, wow, what a practice. And then you read what the meditation is. Yeah? And if you really think about it, taking your own body, you know, removing your consciousness from this body, chopping this body up and giving it to the spirits who, like, munch on it. Mm. Yeah, with the blood dripping like this. Yeah, when you really read. And then there, you know, all these spirits who had very afflicted minds who were going to harm you, now they feel satisfied and happy. Yeah. And we go, I'm not sure if I want to do this meditation. Yeah. It sounds very romantic when you watch it, but when you really think of giving your body that way. Yeah. Considering that when a mosquito bites, we don't want to even give a few drops of blood. Yet we think, you know, and sure, I'm going to imagine that the whole trip giving my body. Okay, so that's the purpose of that kind of meditation, is it really challenges us and it brings up a sense of I and mine in a very strong way, so that then we can focus and say the I that I think is existing, that I'm holding on to so much at this point, does that really exist in the way it's appearing to me? The I that's the mind, that's the possessor, the owner of the body. You know, does such an I exist? Yeah. So the purpose of that kind of meditation is to bring this kind of grasping up very clearly, so that then we can use our wisdom to investigate, you know, do I and mind actually exist the way I think they do? So actually, if you do this meditation and you feel a little bit uncomfortable and scared, it means that it's good, because then you're getting the sense of I and mind to look at. Of course, whenever we get that sense, we get so scared that we stop. You know, don't we? Yeah, even when we're scared about something else, you know, how often do we stop and really say, oh good, now I can look at I and mine. There it is. The object of the self-grasping is so vivid. You know, we at that time we forget all about it, don't we? All of our dharma, gone beyond, you know, forgotten. So be it. So this is exactly the time when we need to recall it. Okay. So they gain mental satisfaction. Their malicious thoughts and evil deeds are pacified. Okay. The altruistic intent of awakening mind is born in their mind streams, and the two collections of merit and wisdom are perfected. Imagine that thereby their mind streams are imbued with the bliss of the perfect body of truth. In other words, the wisdom Dharmakaya. Okay? So this part is quite nice, you know, really thinking that these beings who suffered so much from malicious thoughts and grudges and vengeance, that their minds are satisfied. So a lot of times when people are angry at us or hold grudges against us, we're kind of nervous and we're afraid of them. Like now, you know, everybody's afraid of terrorists. Yeah, I'm kind of nervous. Or, you know, if somebody was stalking you, you're kind of, you know, you're nervous about it and what's going to happen. And in this kind of visualization, instead of being nervous and anxious or terrified and frightened of these beings, what you do is you give them what they want mentally, and you imagine, you know, because you have a sense of their suffering and how much they suffer because their minds are so filled with vengeance and grudges and how suffering their mind states are. And so you imagine that by giving them this gift, the suffering in their mind ceases And so they're wishing, their wish to destroy other people's happiness in order to feel good, because that's what revenge is, you know, that wish inside them is completely pacified and that their mental suffering is pacified, and therefore they don't create all this negative karma from harming others through holding grudges and having revenge. In the Vajrayogini practice, for the people who do it, there's one part called the Kusali offering, where you imagine ejecting your consciousness from your body and then chopping your body up, using your skull as a bowl and putting the parts of your body in there and then transforming that into blissful wisdom nectar. And you offer it to your root teachers, to your direct teachers, to the lineage lamas, to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to the Dakinis and protectors, to all sentient beings. And at the end, you offer it especially to those who wish to harm you because of some karma that we have with them from us having harmed them in the past. And personally, I find that part of the visualization very good, because, you know, really thinking of the suffering, the mental suffering of the people who, due to whatever I did in the past or due to whatever kind of misunderstanding they had about my actions or whatever the reason is, want, you know, have very strong grudges and want to harm me. And just instead of thinking, oh, I'm afraid of them and what are they going to do with me, really putting myself in their shoes and thinking, wow, how much they're suffering. And here, by my making this offering, may they be freed of all that suffering. You know? And I find it quite effective for the mind to do that. Because it's very often the opposite way than how we feel like reacting towards those people, isn't it? But it's quite effective. Okay. There is a verse which says, the result of health is happiness, and the fruit of harm is misery. See your own condition as an example, and do not inflict harm on others. Okay? So if we're making this offering to repay the debt that we had because we inflicted harm on others, then to remember this, you know. And next time the urge comes in our mind to inflict harm because we have hurt feelings or our trust has been betrayed or people haven't treated us the way we think they should, instead of having this mind of revenge and wanting them to have a taste of their own medicine, to remember the result of help is happiness, the fruit of harm is misery. Okay. And then seeing from our own experience that whenever we dish out harm to others, it comes back to ourselves. You know. And so why do that? What's the purpose? Okay. So this is, you know, it's very important that we train ourselves this way, because sometimes when we get really angry, like when somebody has really pushed one of our buttons big time, and our mind just gets so tight. You know how that happens? You know, you feel that sometimes? Your mind just like, you know, and it's like so closed down, and I am never going to forgive them. I hate them. And, you know, and to think, wow, what am I doing to myself when I let my mind get in that state? Yeah, because that kind of mental state is harming me foremost. Yeah, it's making me miserable now. It makes me create negative karma, which will bring suffering upon myself later on. So why hold on to that mental state? Why? Yeah. But then sometimes people tell me, yeah, that's all, it sounds very reasonable and logical, but in my heart, I can't let go of the anger. Mm-hmm. You know? I want revenge. I want them to know that they hurt me. I want an apology. I want. Yeah? That's a, you know, and that's a horrible state of mind to be in, isn't it? It's so much suffering because we've completely given our power away. Yeah? And we've made our power dependent upon somebody else suffering, thinking that if they suffer, we'll feel better. And then we write Christmas cards, may the world live in peace and all beings be well and happy. So this is the time when we really have to look at our minds and, you know, make things concordant instead of, you know, writing one thing and thinking another. And also just looking at our experience. Whenever we've gotten revenge, have we felt good in the long term about it? Yeah? You know, in the moment you might think, oh, good, they got it. Yeah? And then after that moment, do you have respect for yourself? Do you really feel good about what you did? Does it really alleviate your own pain? And so this is, you know, when I look at the issue of capital punishment, I think many people who, you know, the family of victims, think that somehow their suffering is going to be eliminated if the perpetrator who killed their dear one is executed. Yeah. But I don't think that actually eliminates your feeling of loss and the suffering you have. Yeah. That, if you're listening to it, that's our chipmunk, one of our chipmunks, Charlie. Charlie likes to sing this time of evening. Chanting mantra. Okay. The same practice of giving should be repeated towards all beings in every direction. Think of giving your body just as before to every sentient being without exception, living in the worlds in the eastern direction, as numerous as grains of sand in the Ganges River. Then give likewise to those in the other main directions and subdirections. Okay? So in other words, to all living beings, you imagine giving your body in all the different ways that we described before, transforming it into a wish-fulfilling jewel and it becoming whatever they need and so on. Okay. Now we're on the section of offering to those who have attained a spiritual path. In other words, people who have entered either the hearer, Shravaka, hearer, solitary realizer, or bodhisattva path, in beginning with the path of accumulation. Make offerings to the practitioners of the modest vehicle by transforming your body into wish-fulfilling forms which meet their needs. Okay. So the modest vehicles, so those who are the hearers and the solitary realizers who are striving for arhatship. Imagine that each one of them provides okay, so you're transforming your body into wish-fulfilling forms. Imagine that each one provides the practitioner with the perfection of the two collections, so merit and wisdom of that particular vehicle, the complete causes and conditions, inner and outer, to actualize the state of a Buddha, the transcendent subduer, in this very life, and that thereby they experience the bliss of the perfect truth body, the Dharmakaya, in their mind streams. So even though these are practitioners who are striving for arhatship, when we imagine transforming our body into wish-fulfilling jewels, which become what we want, we imagine that as a result they're able to attain the full enlightenment of a Buddha. In other words, that their minds shift and they become focused on full enlightenment. In like manner, offer your body to followers of the great vehicle, the Mahayana, from those on the paths of accumulation and preparation up to the great bodhisattvas on the 10th bhumi, or the 10th level. Think that they too obtain the bliss of the perfect truth body in their mind streams through the perfection of the two collections. Okay, so here we're offering to various realized spiritual practitioners. So we may think, well, you know, who am I? I'm nobody. How can I offer to them, imagining that they become Buddhas? But this is still a very good practice, because even though we have a lot of respect and admiration for these beings, no matter what path they're on, and even though they're more realized than we are, still, because they haven't become fully enlightened beings, we want to support them in their practice and facilitate their practice. And so we imagine giving our body in the form of a wish-fulfilling jewel, which becomes whatever they need in order to complete the two collections and become and attain the Dharmakaya, the truth body of the Buddha. Next, offer your body to your direct spiritual masters. So those are the people that you take teachings from. Those belonging to the lineage, so the lineage that traces back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And to the fully awakened beings, the bodhisattvas, residing in the infinite extensive worlds of the ten directions. Okay, so if you remember in the King of Prayers, when they talk about in the ten directions, you know, on every atom is a Buddha surrounded by Buddhas and bodhisattvas, and they're teaching the Dharma, and the whole assembly is listening. And this is going on throughout infinite space. So this is what you think. Yeah? And you just imagine all these different pure lands with the various holy beings in them. Or different world systems too, where there's all sorts of practitioners who are sincerely practicing the Dharma. Imagine creating many bodies before each of them. So you go before each of these practitioners, and you imagine your body becomes many bodies, and that these bodies have numerous arms and hands, and okay, so we have, and actually faces, so many faces with many mouths, many arms, which enables us to offer innumerable prostrations stimulated by an understanding of the advantages to be gained thereby due to the process of actions and results. So we imagine ourselves not as, you know, little old me, but, you know, as beings with multiple heads, multiple arms, multiple bodies, and then all these bodies are prostrating, all these bodies are making offering. All these mind streams are having thoughts of reverence and confidence in the Triple Gem, and having the bodhicitta motivation to emulate the three jewels. Okay? And so we make offerings and prostrations, and it's stimulated by an understanding of the advantages to be gained thereby due to the process of actions and results. So we understand that, you know, due to the law of karma and its results, that, you know, by making offerings, by showing respect, that these practices, and by doing them elaborately in this kind of way, that these practices have such great results and we create great merit. And then understanding that through the creation of great merit, that like acts as fertilizer for our mind. So then when we listen to teachings, when we sit down to practice, the teachings, which are like seeds planted in our mind stream, the meaning can begin to sprout and grow into realizations. Okay, so this is important to understand about cause and effect like this, because I know for myself, at the beginning when I saw all this stuff about making prostrations and making offerings and all this kind of worship stuff, yeah, I was like, whoa, what's going on here? But then when you understand something about karma and you see that it's not just giving offerings because somebody else wants you to, but it's making offerings because we need to transform our mind into a mind that takes delight in giving, you know, and when we begin to have some confidence in the law of cause and of karma and its effect, and see that when we have a generous mind stream and act out of that, that that's going to bring certain results, and when we have a stingy mind stream and act out of that, it's going to bring other very different results. So we begin to have some faith in karma and its effects. And with that mind, then we want to accumulate merit. We also want to spread satisfaction and spread happiness by making offerings. Okay? Yeah? And I say this because lots of times Westerners, you know, we don't understand why doing all these kinds of practices. And especially in the Tibetan tradition, we have so many totally befuddling ways of making offerings. You know, you see these torma offerings that are sculpted this way in different shapes and sizes, and some of them taste good and some of them don't. And, you know, and we have all these kind of extravagant thing, and you go, why are people doing all of this? It's so, you know, making such a big deal externally. Yeah. But when you really understand how to change your mind and the benefits of changing your mind into a mind of one that is generous, and how then making these offerings is a reflection of that mental state and the happiness that mental state brings you now and also in the future because of karma and its effects, and how it will help propel you towards enlightenment, then with that kind of understanding, then making prostrations, making offerings, and so on, then it becomes quite nice and quite automatic and comfortable. It doesn't become some weird kind of practice. Hmm? I heard of Rilpo Rinpoche. I don't know if any of you met him. A very, very old lama. And he passed away a couple of years ago from cancer. And he was in the hospital. And I heard that at one point, because he was kind of like in and out of consciousness as he was dying, that at one point he kind of woke up in his hospital bed, and his attendant was there, and he said, "Oh, there are so many Buddhas here. Quick, set up the altar and make offerings." I was so struck by that. You know? I mean, it's saying something about his realizations that he's seeing Buddhas in the room. I don't know. I mean, when you have morphine, you know, some people see monsters, some people see Buddhas. But I don't know if he had morphine or not. But anyway, you know, it doesn't matter. But that his instinctive reaction was, there's a holy being, let's make an offering. In other words, let me make a connection, because when we make offerings, we make connection. Okay? And so quick, let's make that connection with that holy being. Let's not miss that opportunity. And so also, you know, with sentient beings, we should feel that way. You see sometimes, you know, the lamas who come here give each of us a mala or some sort of thing. You know, then just different ways of making connections even with sentient beings so that we can be of benefit to them. So when we're, you know, saying mantras out loud or saying mantras to the various bugs that we find in the house, we're making that connection with them that in the future can ripen and we can benefit them more. Furthermore, imagine immense heaps of inconceivable offerings emanated from this wish-granting body, and that thereby a great uncontaminated peace is born in their minds. Okay? So uncontaminated means that it's not under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. And so by our making offerings, may all these various living beings, especially those who have entered the path, thereby attain, you know, the wisdom of bliss and emptiness, and the truth body, and this uncontaminated peace, which is peace means nirvana. Okay, the guide to a bodhisattva's way of life says, may sentient beings repeatedly make offerings to all the Buddhas, and may they constantly possess the inconceivable bliss of the Buddhas. So by imagining that our offerings cause bliss in the minds of the Buddhas, we're creating cause to have bless ourselves. Now, you don't think, oh, I gave the Buddha this peach, and this peach brings the Buddha uncontaminated bliss. You know, the peach doesn't. Yeah, it's the way that the Buddha is perceiving the peach that brings the bliss. Okay? So we tend to think, oh, this delicious, juicy peach, I want it. If I got it, I'd be blissful. Well, that's not the kind of bliss the Buddhists are experiencing by means of our offering, because they're experiencing the bliss of seeing that the peach is empty of inherent existence, and that the, you know, they as agents receiving the peach are also empty, and so on and so forth. So it's from the force of the Dharma wisdom that they're experiencing the bliss, not because some peach caused it, like we think. May bodhisattvas fulfill the welfare of sentient beings as they wish to do, and may all living beings receive all that the Buddhas have intended for them. Similarly, may the solitary realizers and the hearers enjoy peace. And may all living beings receive all that the Buddhas have intended for them. What do you think the Buddhas intend for us?
Enlightenment.
Yeah, full enlightenment. And all the causes and conditions necessary to attain it. Okay? Yeah. Are we ready to receive that gift? If the Buddha appeared before you and said, I will lead you on the path to enlightenment, are you ready to do it? You know? Well, tomorrow morning, let me sleep late, catch up, you know, my sleep, have a good breakfast, then maybe Buddha we can start, but, you know, I want enough breaks, yeah, and I got to go see my friends sometimes, and a little bit of entertainment, you know, to relax the mind, because practicing Dharma doesn't relax my mind. So this concludes the procedure for giving to the beings dwelling in the world. Okay. Now giving to the environment which the beings inhabit. Okay. So before we were giving to the beings, now we're giving them to the, giving to the environment. The reason we give to the environment is because the environment is the place where the living beings stay. And by improving the environment and the surrounding conditions, then it helps the living beings have temporal and ultimate happiness. That's the reason why. To offer our bodies to the environment beings live in, we send them forth, our bodies, we send them forth to infinite worlds within the 10 directions in the aspects of wish-fulfilling jewels. So we imagine our bodies, our body becomes wish-fulfilling jewels. We send those out to all the infinite worlds in which sentient beings dwell, and all the different realms and places and so on. Transform all impure environments filled with decayed logs, thorns, bushes, sand, crevices, cliffs, wasps, hornets, what else? Mosquitoes, ticks. Huh? Foot? Spiders. Yeah, cockroaches, whatever it is. You transform them. Very interesting. Here, the environment's filled with decayed logs, thorns, bushes, sand, crevices, cliffs are all inanimate. And what did we fill the environment with that was troublesome to us, sentient beings? Isn't that interesting? Mosquitoes, ticks, spiders, cockroaches. Very interesting that we did this. But this is talking about the environment. Okay? So we transform the environment into wonderful pure land in the nature of various precious stones, as level as the palm of your hand, open, extensive, and smooth to touch, stainless and bright, perfumed with sandalwood, scattered with celestial flowers, and fenced and bordered with jewels. So this is a description of a pure land. And it's a description of a pure land for deluded minds like us. Okay? I don't think, this is my own thought, I don't think an actual pure land looks like this, because to me I think an actual pure land would be even greater and not, you know, more beautiful and not so concrete as the description. That's my own thought. Okay? Into the nature of various precious stones, as level as the palms of your hand. So it's nice to imagine, you know, an environment, yeah, where there's all these precious gems all around, and they're very smooth, okay, and you don't need to polish them with linoleum wax or anything like that. Stainless, bright, perfumed with sandalwood, scattered with celestial flowers that don't decay, that you don't have to sweep up later on. Okay, and fenced with or bordered with jewels. So this is, you know, because in our world, jewels and this kind of thing is considered very beautiful and precious, this is how we imagine a pure land looking. I remember, though, one day taking a walk in the autumn when all the leaves are turning different colors, because sometimes in the description of the pure lands, the leaves are made of jewels. And I thought, oh, if the leaves were made of jewels, they actually wouldn't feel the same way as leaves that you know, that we touch, that blow around in the wind, and, you know, and these beautiful colors that they are. Okay. But on the other hand, leaves made of jewels may look more beautiful because they may sparkle more and so on and so forth. Okay, so these pure lands are filled with powdered gold, silver, and pearls, and covered with upala, lily, and lotus flowers. Okay, so you can imagine, here it says, there are beautiful lakes, pools, and ponds containing water possessing the eight pleasing qualities, over which fly different kinds of water birds, singing sweetly, enhancing the scene. So here we have a very beautiful nature scene. So you can think of places that you've been, you know, like just look out the door here and look out the window here, and then embellish them and make them even more beautiful, and think that, you know, this is the kind that we're creating a pure land by offering our body to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But whereas our environment, you know, we have to replant the grass, we have to get rid of the knapweed, you know, these kinds of things. In a pure land, you don't have to do any of that. And also in a pure land, they say that everything in the environment is teaching you the Dharma. So even the sound of the winds in the trees is a Dharma teaching on impermanence. Yeah? And so you can watch, you know. It was interesting because as I was talking, Charlie the chipmunk ran by with a bit of our preta offering in his mouth, you know, just like dashing around. And you think, oh, you know, beings caught in the lower realms, being so close to the Dharma yet so far away, and, you know, may he be freed from, or she be freed from misery of the lower realms. May no beings ever fall into those kind of rebirths. So, you know, just things that you see in your life can become Dharma teachings for you. Okay. The lightning that we're seeing right now, the same way, you know, precious human life is like a flash of lightning in the dark of night. So, you know, Shantideva said, and how, you know, most of the time our minds are so obscured and we're reborn in an unfortunate rebirth, and then this precious human life, which seems so long, is actually, you know, like a flash of lightning in all that obscuration. And so to really make use of it while we have it. And so all these things, you know, can become ways in which we imagine the environment becoming a pure land, or becoming a pure land not just in the sense that it's beautiful, but a pure land in the sense that everything we experience or come in contact with becomes a Dharma teaching for us. Okay, imagine... wait a minute. Where are we? Up here. Think that these constitute magnificent clouds of offerings to assemblies of Buddhas and exalted Bodhisattvas, and that they do not for a moment provide the slightest cause for pride, arrogance, or conceit in the beings who inhabit and enjoy the pleasures of these abodes. So in ordinary samsaric beings, when they are in a pleasant place, they tend to be arrogant and conceited and full of pride. You know, look at me, I'm so rich, I can pay to stay here, I'm with all these other rich, successful people, you know, powerful people, famous people, people in the society with high status, so therefore I must be good, I must be big, I must be successful. And so it's very easy when you're in that kind of environment to have arrogance. But here we're creating a pure land, and so everything in the environment becomes a teaching for living beings, not a cause for the arisal of arrogance and conceit. So even though it's so beautiful and so on, nobody develops that kind of haughtiness or conceit or smugness. So it's kind of asking us to check how we feel when we happen to be in very beautiful environments. Yeah? What goes on in our mind? Think that on the contrary, all these beings realize enlightenment due to such favorable conditions. The guide to a bodhisattva's way of life says, may everywhere the earth be pure, free from stones and pebbles, level as the palm of my hand, and smooth in the nature of aquamarine. So this is one of the verses in the morning prayers that we do. May all embodied beings uninterruptedly hear the sound of the doctrine, issuing from birds, trees, beams of light, and even from space. Okay. Then, giving away our possessions. Those to whom we should give are the same order as before. So we completed giving away our body, now giving away our possessions. So essentially it's saying we're going to do it the same way we did before. Okay, so the same order as before, and thinking about friends and strangers and enemies and beings of the six realms and, you know, we all this. So we should send forth our possessions, such as food, clothing, dwellings, companions, employees, and so forth, in forms that fulfill all wishes. Imagine that extensively satisfying the needs of beings in all the worlds generates mundane and transcendental wealth, which creates the causes for accomplishing the fully awakened state. And after attaining enlightenment, their minds obtain the bliss of the perfect truth body. As before, we subsequently offer wish-fulfilling wealth to the spiritual masters and Buddhas, and imagining that a special uncontaminated bliss is born in their mind streams. I think instead of Buddhas, it should be offering to the spiritual masters and bodhisattvas and arhats. You know, because the Buddhas, we offer to the Buddhas, but here we're specifically offering to further the path in the minds of beings who haven't yet attained the Dharmakaya. Okay, so it's essentially saying to do the same kind of meditation that we've just been talking about, but instead of imagining giving away our body and our body becoming a wish-fulfilling jewel, or our body multiplying and expanding and going out, that instead we're taking our possessions and giving them away, you know, in the same way, and that beings are experiencing bliss, temporal and ultimate bliss. They're gaining realizations. We're purifying the environment. We're offering to the hearers, the solitary realizers, the bodhisattvas, to our spiritual mentors, to everybody. Okay, so the same thing. Except here it's our possessions. So this seems very timely, considering that, you know, we've spent the last few days and are still in the process of moving into Gotami House. And so since people are, you know, almost everybody is changing rooms, all of you are, aren't you? Everybody except me is changing rooms where they live. And, you know, so it's a chance to really give away things that you've been accumulating, you know, and to make charity. And so here's this meditation that goes along with it. So when you sit and you do the meditation, you know, oh yeah, I give away this and I give away that and I give away my abode and my possessions and my money and, you know, all my souvenirs from when I was young and all my scrapbooks, all my little mementos and, you know, all my jewelry and all my photo albums. Yeah, so it's great to do when you're sitting in the meditation hall. Taking and giving meditation, isn't it? You know? And like, so nice to think, oh, I'm going to give away all my sports equipment, all my furniture, all my this, all my that. But then, when you have to change rooms and make it part of your practice to actually give away some of your stuff and downsize, what does the mind do? What's your mind doing these last few days? Huh? It puts it out and takes it back. Yeah, giving and taking. so give out. You give something of yours away, and then take back two new things. Okay. Yeah, but as you're going through your stuff and packing it up and moving it, you know, what goes through your mind as you're seeing all this stuff? You know, even though most of you don't have a lot of stuff right now, you know, you've had to pare down sufficiently to come here. But still, look at how, even though, you know, we might think, oh, I'm so renounced, I don't have very much stuff compared to what I used to have. But does our mind relate to the little stuff we have? It might even have more attachment than we have, you know? So how's our mind handling this? And when you look at different things and, you know, maybe you think to give them away and then you see that in somebody else's room and they're using it, but not in the way that you think it should be used. You know, because has the mind really given up the sense of this is mine? Yeah. Or do you kind of look over and survey all your stuff and think, oh, if I give up that pair of socks, for sure in the winter my feet are going to be cold. You know, I can't give them up. Very interesting, isn't it? You know, what our mind does. I haven't seen the bags in the furnace room for the Goodwill getting much fuller. Did you put your old socks in there? Oh, somebody did for you? Oh, I didn't. I used one of your old socks as a rag. That holes in it. I thought it wasn't worth giving away. Yeah. But it's amazing, isn't it, how much we hang on to stuff. No? And even though we talk about, oh, yes, generosity creates so much good karma. But this is my book. And I haven't looked at it in 3 years, but I'm not going to give it away. Yeah.
This conscientious reaction is quite delightful. Very, very prepared for this new story.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a very good point, that sometimes it's quite amazing to see that our spontaneous reaction is to give. You know? I mean, we just look at something as you clean something. You know, it's like, oh, yes, I can give this. And then the next thought is, no way. But it's interesting sometimes how the spontaneous thought is to give. And then the mind, the superstitious mind, the mind of Namtok, says, oh, but if I give, then I won't have. Yeah, so I can't give.
what you said about holding on to the other stuff that we have even more. So like I've always found that I like to get rid of stuff and it makes me feel quite good.
Uh-huh.
It's just so relieving. Just like, you know, you're holding on to it and you're so attached to it. And you're just like, this is garbage. I don't want it. But just, I don't use it. I'll never use it. You know, I'm just going to give it to somebody or whatever. And that feels really good.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked that. And then like you kind of cut your possessions in half. You get rid of half. And then you have the other half that you're like, oh, but this stuff, I've gone through it. And I've made sure that not only is it necessary, but it's quite important to me, you know, sentimentally, and you know, so you kind of like rationalize how that stuff's more important than the other crap that you threw out that you never needed to begin with. And then, you know, 6 months later,
you should be saying this here. Come up here and say it. I won't be able to breathe in all the glory because I'm sitting back so they can see you in the camera.
So I was saying that I often go through my stuff and get rid of it kind of regularly, and it always brings a really good feeling because I'm holding on to something very tightly, and I feel like it's so important. And then I just throw it out, and I feel so relieved afterward because it's just a kind of weight taken off the mind, I guess I would say. And so it's like taking my possessions and kind of getting rid of half of them. And then, you know, the other half, I've rationalized and kind of deduced why these things are more important than the crap that I threw out that I never needed to begin with. And then 6 months later, I go look at that stuff. And I'm like, well, you know, this half of this stuff, I don't really need so much. It's just actually just garbage. I was just holding on to it out of a mind of attachment. So I'll just get rid of that. But these, you know, these few things that are left, they're quite important, and I should really hold on to them because I'll definitely need them. Since, you know, as you said, I haven't used or even seen them in over 2 or 3 years, but definitely I will need them at some point. So that's kind of my process.
Anybody else have comments how you've been working with this process of moving? Are you watching the eye and mind come up? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mine wasn't so much about the stuff. So mine wasn't so much about the stuff as it was about having a private room. Venerable Tarpa and I had agreed and talked about beforehand that it would be really lovely to actually continue to share our space. And I thought in my mind, it would not be good for me actually to have it in my own room. It's really good for me to have the consideration of living with somebody. I think it's very, very healthy for me rather than to just be able to come and go at any hour of day and night, turn the light on when I want to, and read as late as I want, and all the things that I can't do with the roommate that I have. So that seemed like a very clear decision. I was very happy with it until people started moving furniture into their private rooms. And then Sarah and I are kind of together. I mean, it's big enough, but we're pretty close in there. And then, you know, Venerable Femke's got a new rug, and she's got this really nice bookcase, and her room is huge. And what was I thinking? So it was very fun to watch that come up. I think it was so obviously like, oh, what about me? It was like a cartoon. So it was very easy to watch. So in fact, Venerable, your teaching just the other day was, you know, when those things come up, when do we say, my mind is not perceiving this picture accurately? I'm not perceiving the nature of reality accurately. It was a very, very helpful meditation, but that's where I started grasping my own space, because everybody else was getting a beautiful new space, and I have a beautiful new space too, but it's kind of crowded compared to others. But I'm actually quite happy for it. I don't know where you are with this. I recommit.
Anybody else? Oh, you're all so quiet. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
you're getting true confessions from the monastic community.
Well, a couple things for me. One is whenever there's moving going on, it always reminds me of when my mom died and us kids went and cleaned out her house, which she lived in for over 50 years, and it was just jam-packed. And that process, it was like, at first it was like, oh, you know, things we should keep because it's a reflection or a reminder of her. And after we got into it, pretty soon it was like, out, out, you know, everything out. So moving always reminds me of that. So that was a helpful experience because through that, I kept seeing that all of that stuff had no meaning, had no meaning on, you know, her life and all that stuff she had around her. You know, didn't do a thing. The process here for me, I think what my mind is doing is it's kind of similar to yours, where you kind of watch and see kind of who's getting what. You know, kind of that line. Who's getting what? Where's it going? So it's kind of that line. Interesting.
Yeah. Who gets to keep this in their new room? Who is it? Oh, you know, the piece of furniture is getting taken away. Yeah. Why is it going there and not to me? And how come they get to take two boxes of stuff and Venerable keeps looking at me? You know, kind of saying, how come you have so much stuff and everybody else has more stuff? Why does she pick on me? You're nodding your head, okay? Yeah, so like I said the other morning, it's a very fruitful time, really, to look at the mind and how the mind's reacting, you know, and the sense of mine, you know, mine from about the stuff we already have, and then how the mind is now getting shifted onto new rooms. Yeah. So what used to be somebody else's room, where you didn't care at all if the kitties threw up on the carpet. Now, if it's your room, you care a whole lot if the kitties throw up there. Yeah. So it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, and who gets to move into what room? And who said they can move? How come they get to choose what room they're moving into, and I didn't get to choose what room I'm moving into? You know, how come they got to choose first, and I had to take the remainders? And you know, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? Just how constantly, I, me, my, constantly. Yeah. And yet, after we move in and we get settled, we're going to forget all about the whole thing. Hopefully. Because yeah. if you don't, you're not going to make it here. Because you're going to be walking around fuming all the time. How come you got that plant? How come I have to store tables in my room? How come I have to store stuff? My closet. Yeah. So, yeah?
This is a question from one of the viewers. And this goes back to when you were speaking earlier about the Buddhas and how they felt bliss because they saw the emptiness. The question is, are the Buddhas also experiencing bliss because someone is making offerings, i.e. because of the act, not the substance?
Okay, so are the Buddhas, when they experience bliss, all experiencing bliss not only because they're experiencing bliss and emptiness from the offering, but also because they're very joyful that somebody else is making an offering? Yes, definitely because of that, you know, because they want the best for us, And so when we're actually doing something that creates virtue, of course the Buddhists and Bodhisattvas are very happy about it. So we're way over time. Let's just dedicate now and try and do this meditation in the upcoming week.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all iron inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Idam
Guru Ratna Mandala Kanyatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious body, mind not yet born, arise and grow. May the born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tents and gates of generosity, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions. And especially Atravastiya in the west. Oh.